Hi, everyone. I'm Judy. A very grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of the Al-Anon Family Groups, which includes Alateen. It seems strange to actually have an in-person gathering, doesn't it? I'm glad it's intimate and small so we can kind of warm up to what's to come. My home group is Thursday Night Love and Laughter in Reno on Mount Rose Highway, so if you're coming our way, come my way. We've gone back to in-person, and we're still doing a hybrid, so we set up the TV, and some people are still at home, and some people are in the room. So we're doing the best we can, given what's happening. And I was reflecting last night. In fact, I couldn't go to sleep. I was just thinking, Cliff was so right when he spoke last night and said, there's something about being together that you cannot duplicate. You can't do it on the screen. I think he said rubbing knees. I don't know. We don't rub knees in Al-Anon, but, you know, shoulders and hands. And, but he's right. It felt like a miracle just to be back. And I related to so much of what Cliff said last night, and I'm thinking this is ironic, isn't it? Because we're in different programs. He's in AA and I'm in Al-Anon. And yet, I loved his wild socks, I noticed. I like wild socks, and I love red Twizzlers licorice. I also related to him thinking that he didn't really need to be in that meeting, and all of those things that sound so familiar. And I'm thinking, why didn't I know that earlier? You know, I might not have had to come to the program if I had known that. But I have to tell you today, thanks to the steps, traditions, concepts, slogans, sponsorship, service, and just participation, I think I'm an ordinary person living a very extraordinary life. I don't know how else to describe it. I don't. I've been around a long time. That doesn't mean I'm wiser. I am definitely older. I know that. And we say in Al-Anon we share our experience, strength, and hope. And for me, it was sort of experience, pain, and growth. That's what it was. I came to you in 1981. I don't get excited. I didn't stay. I didn't like it. I had read about it in a newspaper. People are hardly reading these days, let alone having a newspaper, so I feel like a dinosaur there. But thankfully, our district published a list of meetings once a month in the paper, and it was in the living section, bottom left, and it said, are you concerned about someone's drinking? And it listed all the meetings. And I read that every month, and my answer was, yes, I am concerned about someone's drinking. But, you know, I didn't act on it. Part of my problem has been indecision and paralysis. So I thought it was a good listing, but it took me a long while to actually call the number. And, of course, I had to do it with a friend. You know, I wasn't capable of doing anything on my own decisively. So I called the answering service. A woman named Jeannie said, sure, I'll take you to a meeting. Come on over to my house. I mean, I don't think people would say, I don't say that on the answering service today when somebody calls, but she said, come on over, here's my address, and we'll go together. And I drove over there, parked in her driveway, and went up to her door. She opened, welcomed me, and said, okay, let's go to the meeting. And I turned around, and my car wasn't in the driveway anymore. I was so nervous. I had a stick shift car. I had left it in neutral. Her driveway was a little slanted, and my car had rolled right down her driveway and across the street. Now, how embarrassing. You know, you blame that on the alcoholic, usually, but that was me. And so that's how I went to my first meeting. It was at St. Ludmilla's Church. It was in the basement. We were in the kitchen. The light was bad. People were old. People were whining, I thought. And there was laughter in the other room. I could hear laughter coming from somewhere, and I thought, you know, it sounds more fun in there. I didn't even know who was in there, but I have since learned. They get the bigger room and more light, but, you know, not that I'm resentful or anything. But it was a basement meeting. I looked around, and I thought to myself, you know, if this is as good as it gets, I mean, I'm barely 30. I don't want to eat pie on a Friday night with these people at the Happy Chef restaurant. I mean, I just didn't see it as a real social life, you know. And I thought I was smarter and cooler and knew more. And that all, of course, wasn't true. I took the book. Jeannie gave me a daily reader, a one-day-at-a-time book. And she wrote in it, "We all love you. Say the Serenity Prayer, Jeannie," and she put the date. And that's the only way I know that I really came in on that date, because it was November 17th, 1981. And what I noticed mostly was the cost of the book up in the right corner. We always write the price. And I thought, wow, she spent $375 on me, you know, and she doesn't even know me. And I've since learned that that's a good way to carry the message. Because I went home in my probably self-righteous way, and I said I had been to Al-Anon. And Al-Anon does not give advice, but I'll just tell you from my perspective, that's not a good thing to say. It wasn't necessary, and it wasn't received well. And my husband looked at me. We had only been married 11 months, and he said, "Count me out." Now, I didn't know that what he knew about Al-Anon, but I guess he suspected we were a secret society who was about to gang up on him or something. I don't know what he thought, but, you know, I didn't want to rock the boat. I was newly married, and so I took that little Odette book and those pamphlets, and I put them in the back file drawer in the back room. Bottom drawer. And that's where they stayed for a while. And as you know, it's a progressive illness and things progressed. And I wasn't sure if my husband was having an affair or if he was gay. I was speculating on the reasons as to why he didn't come home. You know, Al-Anon people are good at making up stories. My friend says, if you don't know the facts, you make stuff up. And so I made up a lot of stuff about what he was probably doing. You know, basically he was probably just quietly drinking and enjoying his drinks, but I had this idea. But when I went back in April of 1985, that was after a trip we had driven to Chicago. We were living in Cedar Rapids, Iowa at the time. We had moved there from Wisconsin. So when I moved there, I knew no one, had no friends, had no job yet, so I was really alone. And I exhibited all those traits of the family member. You heard Cliff talk about last night, the neurotic family member. Well, yeah, I was neurotic. That was just a small feature. You know, I was obsessed with his time. Where was he all the time? And the money, you know, we both had jobs, and yet there was no money. And then his friends, oh my God, you know, I was very clear about his friends. I called them lowlifes and scums. Those were my terms. And later I came to know them as Mike and people who had real names, but not initially. So in the end, I was a person who drove a car that had no headlights that worked. They hadn't worked for over a year. My only theory was you just don't go out at night. And that made perfect sense to me. I didn't comb my hair in the back. I couldn't see it. Why comb it? I didn't have any curtains or shades on the windows. I had thought about it, but hadn't made any decision. We'd lived there a number of years. But it became easier to look out the window without any shades. You know, you could see better. See what was going on when the car came home. And I had my watch window in the kitchen. And we were kind of up on a little hill, so I could look down upon the garage. And, you know, check things out. I watch window. So there I was, few clothes in the closet. I was spying, reading matchbooks, bar napkins, looking at phone numbers. And I needed to be in Al-Anon. I did need to go back. I didn't want to go back, but I knew that there was a place for me to go. And I arranged through my work. I went in and talked to my boss, and I said, he was the first person I had been honest with, and I told him what was going on at home and that I really needed to attend a meeting. He said, sure, we'll adjust your schedule, and you can go. So I started going stealthily, and I didn't announce at home that I was going. I would go at noon, and three things happened for me really quickly there. One was identification. I didn't want to be there, but I identified. That little 20 questions, we have a leaflet, asks you, you know, are you concerned about someone's drinking? Do you lie? Do you this? Well, I learned real quick. I was a worried, broke liar. And there were only two out of the 20 that I didn't say yes to. And one was about, do you feel like calling the police or something? And I didn't have to call them because they showed up occasionally. So that was off. And then the other one was, you know, would you like to harm yourself or something like that? And I didn't really want to kill myself, but I did want to be dead. You know, I knew that. And I was still living. So my only option was to come to the meetings. The second one was education, and I'm so grateful that Al-Anon has published all of the pamphlets and our books, and over time we have, the books have grown with the fellowship, as the fellowship has grown and expanded. I read those pamphlets, and especially the one Understanding Ourselves in Alcoholism. It says right in the first paragraph that the American Medical Association had determined that alcoholism was an illness, and that it could be arrested but not cured. And when I read that, I thought, that is an amazing piece of information. I mean, how do we not know that out there in the world? You know, I thought he was having fun. I thought it was against me. It's an illness. It's a disease. And you know, if it was good enough for the AMA, and they were educated people who belonged to that group, it was good enough for me, and I accepted that. The thing is, I could hardly remember it very long, because when something happened again, I would be angry and upset, so I would have to go back and read my literature. But that was so helpful to me. The Merry-Go-Round in Denial is another wonderful pamphlet, and it describes the family disease of alcoholism in three acts, like a play. In the first act, things are wonderful. You know, exciting. And that was true when I was married. We had a lot of great times, kind of wild times. I was thinking when I was flying here that one time we were out in the Mississippi River, and my husband always had fixer-uppers, you know, things that he could create and do. And he bought a little boat and a used motor, and we were out there for its maiden voyage on the river. And the paint was washing off because I realized that he had used water-based paint, you know, just paint. So we're out there, and the motor suddenly, it blew up like it was on fire. And we're in this little boat, and there's this huge barge coming down the river, and we have no pail or anything. And we were bailing with beer cans to try to put out the fire on the motor. And from the big barge comes this, do you need any help out there? And of course, no, we're fine, you know. The boat's sinking, the motor's blowing out, but we're fine, you know. So there were a lot of incidents like that. Initially, they were fun and kind of funny. But eventually, you know, Al-Anon members turn. They don't care for that anymore. We want a calmer life. And so that merry-go-round named Denial pamphlet, I realized we're in the third act. I mean, we are serious progression of the illness. And it said that I could hold the key, perhaps. You know, if I went to meetings, that I could learn some things and I could get educated. And my favorite pamphlet of all time is So You Love an Alcoholic. I mean, even the title is hard to swallow when you come into the meeting, because it's true. And I think, what a loser am I? You know, who did I pick? I'm not doing very well. But it has a lot of good suggestions in there, like learn the facts. Go to meetings. Go to open AA meetings. Learn from real people having real alcoholism. Don't be a doormat. Don't make threats you won't carry out. So besides identifying, getting educated, it gave me a plan of action. Because I realized that I had a lot of changing to do. I did all those things that are the don'ts. And so in my home group, we talk about doing the don'ts. You got to quit doing the don'ts and start doing the do's. And it's a whole nother way to behave. And it was very foreign and very unfamiliar to me. I mean, one of them was to be kind. Kind? Really? But that was my first big change. There's a line in our One Day at a Time book that says, lay down your weapons and pick up your tools. And on that page, it talks about courtesy. And we had gotten far from being courteous in our house, I'll tell you. And my friend said the other day, she said, my grandma used to say, don't let the screen door hit you in the place the Lord split you. Well, we said things like that to each other and, you know, worse things. And I had to learn again to say, thank you. Thanks for taking out the trash. Good to see you. Hope you had a good day. I mean, prior to that, it was, where the hell have you been? It's dinner time and you're late. But all of those things had to go out the window because it was sort of up to me. My husband continued to drink. So that first year in Al-Anon, it was the simple things. It was courtesy for me. It was a few of the slogans. The steps seemed far too complicated. I knew I was dealing with a family illness, but I could apply Easy Does It or First Things First. I would be tempted to get in the car and go look for him, but I knew that what I needed to do really was the dishes. So I did the dishes. And I began to clean up the house. And my sponsor, at this time I had a sponsor, and I did get a sponsor after about 6 months in the program, and I related to what Cliff said last night because she was the person waiting at the door for me. Big woman. 6 foot, fingernails, large, long time in the program. She scared me, and I would just try to get past her. But there's only so much space in the doorway, you know. And we had only one door. You had two. You had a better choice. And I couldn't get past her. And she would always turn, and she would want to hug me. I mean, I'd worry about it in the meeting, that she would want to hug me. Nobody had hugged me or done anything like that, a stranger. And sure enough, she hugged me, you know, and called me honey. And how could I not ask her to be my sponsor, you know? And she became my sponsor. And she taught me a lot of things real fast. And one she said was, honey, it takes two to argue. Isn't that something? So if I check out of the argument, there's a person arguing with himself, perhaps, but I'm not in it. That was huge. She said, stop asking all those questions. Where have you been? Why are you so late? What did you have for lunch? And I learned that here, knowledge, when it's meant to come to you, will come with no effort on your part. In other words, you trust that it'll come to you when it's supposed to. I couldn't believe that. I thought being inquisitive and curious was a character asset. You know, I needed to know, but she taught me that. And she said, you don't always have to be right, honey, and we talk about that in Al-Anon. You know, do you want to be happy or do you want to be right? I'd like to be both. You know, but sometimes it's just okay, you know, to let it go. So I learned that, how important is it? And she said, and honey, just a word, she said, don't be so harsh on his friends. Don't be so judgmental. And I'm going, me? Judgmental? You know? But she was right. And somehow I could hear it from her. I couldn't have heard it from the alcoholic that I was mean to his friends, but I could hear it from her because she was a member of Al-Anon. It was a neutral territory in that meeting, and she was sharing her experience. I mean, I heard stories about her hitting Larry over the head with a frying pan and throwing a flower pot, and I couldn't believe that because when I met her, she seemed wise and serene, and I wanted that, and I didn't have it. I did not have it. So I had only been in Al-Anon 11 months when the miracle happened. My husband drove off to Minneapolis to seek treatment. And really, I had nothing to do with it, except that I stopped standing in his light. And that's what I learned in Al-Anon. You know, if you stop standing in God's light and somebody else's light, you get out of the way, it gives them the freedom to be themselves and to take their own inventory and look at possibilities. And that was such a hopeful time. I tell you, I loved it. We had our anniversary when he was in treatment. I thought, there's no better anniversary than having an alcoholic locked up. You know, it was such a comfort. I knew right where he was. I was happy. I was not in Minneapolis, but it was a nice anniversary for me. And of course, I went to Family Week and, you know, heard the information. And I'm glad it's just one day at a time because you never know what's coming in the future, but it was a good time, and I guess it was 3 weeks. We went out for dinner, and my husband ordered a drink, and I remember we were at the Flamingo restaurant bar. I can see the booth. I think the place is still there in Cedar Rapids, but when he ordered that drink, I didn't say anything. I knew it wasn't my business. And I had learned from my friends in AA because I did go to the open AA meeting the first of every month. I learned a lot from my friends in AA. And slips were common. Struggles are difficult for somebody trying to recover. And I got that, you know. So I just went on eating my meal. I don't remember my meal, but I do remember that he ordered a rum and coke. Now see, I still needed to get the focus on me. But from that drink on, everything that I have ever learned in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is true. From members in good standing in the fellowship, it is that first drink, and it becomes a train wreck. And from that day on, our lives took different directions. But you know what? I was okay. And I think it's in our paths to recovery. It says something about, it's a wonderful quote. Yeah, Al-Anon doesn't promise healed relationships, a life happily ever after, or love from the person who has nothing to give, but only hope for you. And that was a real reminder that I was in the program for me. And that I needed to keep living my life and do what I had learned in Al-Anon, which was to work the steps, get involved, and keep my nose out of other people's business, basically. Because you only get one life, and it goes real quickly. And I have been more aware of that the last few years because I think I'm the longest in my home group. And, you know, people look at me like I should know something. And I'm going, this is creepy. You know, I don't really care for this. I like being the newcomer because everything was hard, but it was magical because it was so new. And I just celebrated my Al-Anon birthday in April at my home group. And I had told a person I sponsor just, I think, a day before the meeting. I said, you know, I don't know what I'm going to share this time. I said, in the beginning, it was so magical. And now sometimes I think that I've heard everything. And I don't know what's new. And then I went to my home group, and I'm sitting there, and I was about to share, and I'm sharing, and I said, you know what? I was wrong. It is so magical, and I feel it today, and I'm so grateful that my life is so different from the day that I walked in, and the magic has not gone away, and I think we heard that last night. You want to come, and you want to get it all, and I'm getting it all. I haven't left, and, you know, every once in a while, I used to be a little resentful, because I would go to conferences like this, and it was always a husband and wife, you know, like Cliff and Lori. I mean, how cool is that? Two people in recovery who made it, and one in Al-Anon, one in AA, and I used to think, you know, that really stinks, because how did they get so lucky? And I think that's the happily ever after story, and it wasn't me. I'm a person now who's married to someone not in either program, and you know what? I'm living the happily ever after, so you just have to keep going on the track until it gets to happily ever after, whatever that miracle is. It may not be what you think it's going to be. You know, I had this vision of how it was going to be. It wasn't that way at all. But I kept working my program. My husband was still out with his friends that I was now calling Mike. Hi, Mike. How are Bonnie and the kids? How's Sean doing? You know, I became human. And they were a bunch of talented, goofy guys. My husband is, I mean, actually he was handsome, creative, all of the talents, and he always had a fixer-upper project. And the big one, one day I was ready to go to work, and I heard noise out in the yard, and I looked out my watch window, and I thought, what's the noise? And there's this big transport truck backing up our driveway with this thing on the back. And my God, I went running out there, and he said, where should I put it? Well, now, what was on the truck was a 39-foot, 13-ton amphibious vehicle, the World War II Army duck. Where should I put it? You can bet I had an idea immediately where he should put that duck. And I said simply, it can't be ours. And he looks, you know, at the lady, oh yeah, it's yours. I'll just back it up over here and park it by the forsythia bush. I went off to work in disbelief, and I have to say, I think that's the only night my husband ever got home on time. He knew it was coming, and of course he was thrilled. Is it here? Oh, there it is, you know, by the forsythia bush. It's hard to kind of disguise a duck, you know, in the yard. In fact, it's embarrassing enough to have the family car outside a familiar bar all the time, but think of a duck being driven to the local bar and a person getting out with a stepladder wearing a Santa hat at Christmas time. You know, you have to have a sense of humor for those things. I hated that duck. And it was a crowd pleaser. All of his friends began to come and help and restore that duck to its natural beauty. He had found it up in the woods in Canada when he'd been on a fishing trip and thought, you know, I can make it beautiful. And he had that talent. And all the guys who worked in stainless steel, wood, you name it, they had custom beer holders made for that duck. And there was a goal in mind. It was to run that in the St. Patrick's Day Parade in March. I mean, that's a highlight in Cedar Rapids. You know, I'm sure every drinker looks forward to that day and goes down to Ted's Happy Time to start it out. I was familiar. And the duck was getting ready and people were getting off work and taking more time and painting. There was a guy spray painting and, it was serious business. And, you know, in fact, I have a friend in Houston. She's an AA and she sent me a note yesterday and she said, if you're going to tell your story, remember to tell them how you looked out and saw those cronies and decided to offer them lunch and a little compassion. And I thought, isn't that interesting? She would remember that. But you know, it was irritating to me. There were so many people out there having so much fun doing something. And I'm in the house by myself. And then they would go to town and have lunch. And so, you know, I had learned that you can offer people lunch. Just because you don't like the fact that they're drinking, you can still offer them food. And so I began to say, you know, I'm going to make lunch around noon. If you guys want to stick around, I'll put some brats on the grill or something. And, you know, people would have lunch. And the spirit of goodwill kind of changed. I still didn't go out and look at the duck. And shortly before St. Patrick's Day, my sponsor said to me, Judy, she said, you know, your husband's worked very hard on that duck. Yes. And she said, I think it would be a good idea if you went to the parade. I thought it'd be a good idea to get a new sponsor right then. But she didn't ask much of me ever. And I guess I didn't resist, but I was horrified. And she said, I'll meet you down at the corner of Merchants National Bank, 12 o'clock, be on the corner. And we'll go to the parade. So I left work, got down on the corner of Merchants National Bank. And if you've ever been in Cedar Rapids, it's on the Cedar River. And it looks kind of like Paris, France. There's actually an island out with the city hall, and it's designed that way. It's very lovely. And she said, well, here they come. And it was like, you know, General Patton coming up the Champs-Élysées and the... in the duck, you know, and I can see him up there driving, and I can see the keg in the back, and the guys in there, they're so thrilled, you know. And she says to me, now when he gets close, I want you to smile and wave. So, I did it. And he's driving east, looking back like, what happened to her? Disbelief that I'm there smiling and waving. And you know what? Suddenly it didn't feel bad. Because she was right. He had worked hard on that duck. I hated to admit it, but it looked brand new. And it was good. And that night I was home. He wasn't home, of course, St. Patrick's Day. I had eaten. He came home, I remember it, with the box of KFC under his arm because he had learned that I eat on time, and if you want to eat, you have to forage for yourself. And he had brought home his chicken, and he came in the door, looked at me and said, thanks for coming today, it meant a lot. And I looked at him and said what I've learned in Al-Anon, you're welcome. And he said, I know you're going to your meeting, aren't you? I said, I am. He said, I know it makes you feel better. I said, it does. And I think from that day on, there was sort of peace in our house, even though he continued to drink. And I continued to be hopeful, and then you sort of lose all hope, and you just live your life. And I always had thought that at the end of our driveway, after I learned that my husband had an illness, we had a light. It had sort of a yellow, soft light in it, and I always turned it on for him. Before, when I was mad at him and I didn't know about alcoholism as a progressive illness, I used to shut it off and lock the door. But my behavior had changed, and so had my attitude. I hoped that he would make it home safely. And I would leave the love light on for him. That's what I called it. And I would say, I'll leave the love light on for you. And I always wished it would be on for me, but it never was. And, you know, after a while, you end up just, you quit looking. But one night I came up over the hill in the fog and I looked down and that light was on. And I knew that he knew I was at a meeting. And from that day on, the love light was always on for me if I was gone. And if the light was burned out, I was informed that the light was out, but it would be back on. And so that's what we did for each other, despite the fact that we were living in two different worlds. My life went on. I began to sponsor Alateen. I was invited to Oregon to speak at an event. In fact, it was this same weekend in May. It was the Rogue River Roundup, and I went. And I felt just very content with my life. You can be happy whether the alcoholic is still drinking or not. That's what I learned in Al-Anon. And I went out on the Rogue River, and I saw the deer down at the water and the eagle in the tree, and a wonderful time. And I thought, my life is good. My life is good. And I came home, and my personal belongings had been moved into the back room, along with my One Day at a Time daily reader set on the nightstand. And I've learned in Al-Anon, if you don't know what to say, the best thing to say is nothing until you figure it out. And so I slept in the back room that night. And I don't know the motivation for that. I think it's illness personified. That's all I know. And my friend said, I think he loved you enough to move you out because maybe he knew he wouldn't get sober. I don't know. But that night in the back room, I thought about higher power and my life. And I thought, you know, I don't think God means for me to sleep in the back room of my own house. I just simply don't. There's more to this life than that. And the next day I picked up the newspaper, which had a whole section of for rent, you know, apartments, etc. And I thought, I'll just turn things over here. And I saw an ad. I called the number. And the voice on the other end said, Judy, is that you? God? I mean, really? One call. It was my friend Dottie that went to the noon meeting when I first went. She and her husband Ken had rental properties, and she was in AA. And, of course, she said to me, you know, very matter of fact, I wondered when you would move out. Why do people always know what you're going to do before you do it yourself in this program? But she said, yes, we have an apartment. So with the help of my friend, I borrowed a little truck from my boss. On that May Monday, I moved. I moved into that apartment. I left the country. I left my dog. I left my two cats. I left my garden, my iris, my peonies. And my sponsor said to me, honey, you can always plant more trees. And she's right. You know, I was waiting for the pets to die, waiting for the apples to come, waiting for next year's blooms. What am I waiting for? You know, I'm getting old sitting here. And my friends moved me, and that night I was at my district meeting. Because now I had a commitment, and I was showing up. And my life took amazing turns from there. And that begins the happily ever after. I was happy. We have a book, From Survival to Recovery. I think a lot of living with alcoholism, active, is exhausting. So it was a lot of survival, but there was also a lot of recovery. But once I moved, it was a new kind of recovery. And it was kind of scary because I was on my own. And I had moved to town, and I'm a country girl. I grew up on a farm. We had lived in the country. But you know what? God sent me a cat to my apartment window right from the neighbors. And I called him CG, the cat from God. I would take off the screen, let the cat in for a while, and then put him out, put my screen back on. You know, if you trust, things work out. So I think it was in August, my sponsor asked me if I would come to the hospital with her. Her mother was dying, and she said, honey, will you come and stay the night with me? Well, I didn't want to, but she didn't ask much. So I went. She was waiting for a brother to come from Texas, and she was annoyed with him because he wasn't showing up. She hadn't been able to reach him, and I thought, I better stick around because I might need to protect him somehow. You know, she's a big woman, and she's hot, and they need to make a decision. And eventually he came. He sat next to me on the couch in that little lobby of the hospital. And he sat on my left, because I remember he looked over and he said, "Who are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm Peggy's friend." "Oh." And I said, "You'll have to ask her about all these friends," because he had wondered who all was in the room there. Because you know how we are in AA and Al-Anon, when there's a crisis, we show up and we're supportive. And the room is full of people, you know, just being there. And I didn't know if he knew that she was in Al-Anon and his brother-in-law was in AA. I said, "You'll have to talk to them." So we left. They made the decision to take his mom off life support. And we went home. I called Peggy's house. I wanted to take some food over, which is, you know, kind of a Midwest thing. You bring a casserole and you can't say anything personal. Very Midwesterns aren't very good at that, but they can bring food. And she said, "Just a minute, my brother would like to talk to you." And I thought, oh, what does he want? You know, that was, I thought he probably wants me to babysit their dog while they go to the funeral home. You know, and I hate that dog, that pool, it stinks, its ears go in the water, it's got bad breath. You know, I'm into this poodle. And he's on the phone and he says, "Would you like to go out to dinner?" Well, I hadn't imagined that. And I thought, well, you know, I'm almost out of free meals. You know, once you move out, you're single, people invite you over and whatnot. But I was at the stage, nobody was inviting me, and I thought, well, it'll be free food. And I said, okay, you know, I mean, that's rather cheap, isn't it? But that was where I was. And I thought, he flew here, I'll be driving. I can dump him if things get tense, you know. So I picked him up. We went to the restaurant. Nice restaurant he picked out, which, you know, I couldn't afford. And we're eating, and he's asking me about Al-Anon and AA. And I'm telling him a little bit. And he says, "Well, I could really learn a lot from you." Well, I had never heard anybody say anything like that, especially to an Al-Anon member, you know. And I'm going, really? Well, I walked him through the whole 12 steps at dinner. I just took advantage of it. And it's amazing he ever called me again, isn't it? He had ordered a beer, but I noticed he stopped. He never drank the whole thing, so I thought that was a comfort, but... we had a nice dinner, and I dropped him off, but then he called me, and I didn't answer the phone. I thought, oh, my gosh. He called and asked if I wanted to go for ice cream, you know, because he had heard that that was an AA Al-Anon thing, I think. Ice cream? Oh, no, that's too personal, you know. So I got in my car, and I headed north to visit my parents. I just left town. I never acknowledged that call. I never did a thing, and... then I start feeling a little bad that I was rude. You know, I remembered this deal about courtesy and being kind, and someone reaches out. And so I called my sponsor and I got his address. I thought, I'll drop him a little note, thank him for the dinner. It was a nice meal. I was glad to meet him. Nice to meet my sponsor's brother, et cetera, blah, 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 you know. And I drove in town, and I remember the drop boxes, and I'm thinking, this might be too nice, you know, should I put it in the box or not? And I dropped it in the box, let it go. I'm back at that same Friday night meeting where people aren't as old and aren't as whiny. That St. Ludmilla's basement church looks pretty good. It's painted up, more light. And I came home that night from St. Ludmilla's, 10 o'clock. I'm looking out my little basement apartment window thinking, life is good. And the phone rings, and it was him. And he said, hello, you know. And I said, did you get my note? And he said, no, did you get mine? I said, no. And he said, would you consider coming to Houston? And I said, you know, what for? And he said, well, to visit, you know. And I said, well, I'm almost ready to go back to work. I said, I am free over Labor Day. And, you know, really, I didn't have a social life except Happy Chef and pie. And he said, I'll split the ticket with you if you want to come. And I said, okay. So I had a ticket. And then the next day I'm thinking, what have I done? You know, I mean, Al-Anon says keep an open mind, but maybe this is too open. But I was supposed to go with my sponsor and some friends. We were going craft sailing on Saturday. And when I saw her, I had to tell her that I wouldn't be showing up. And that was rather uncomfortable because she didn't really like her brother that much, which is ironic. They were kind of quibble at each other, sibling rivalry. And so I told her that I was going to Houston the next day. And Al-Anon friends can be dirty. I'll tell you, we are more than meets the eye. The presents I got, the little gifts, the cards for my trip are all unmentionable. And they had so much fun that I was going to see this guy. And I was getting quite nervous. I was on the plane, and I was fidgeting. There's a magazine that used to be called The Working Girl, and I was reading that, and there was a guy on my left, and I wasn't talking, and I was getting closer to Houston, and he says to me, are you that? I said, what do you mean? He goes, Working Girl. And I said, well, yes, I am, but it's Labor Day, and something, I must have dropped a slogan or something. I said, one day at a time or something, and he turns and he goes, oh, are you a friend of Bill W.? And I said, no, but I know his wife. And so we had a little conversation. He asked me, you know, what I was doing, and I said, well, I may have made a mistake, but I'm on my way to Houston to meet my sponsor's brother. And you know, we had a good chat. He calmed me down. And he said, I'll tell you what, he was from Nebraska, very good-looking guy, a senator, and he had one of those big cowboy Stetson hats. I thought, maybe I should go to Nebraska. Stepping out here. And he said, when we get down to the baggage, he said, I'll check him out. And he said, if I think he looks all right, I'll give you a nod, he said. I never even revealed this until a few years ago. But down at baggage, he gave me the nod, and I had to tell Herb that he had had the official approval stamp of AA before we ever really continued our relationship. And just to shorten it up, Herb and I got married. Not immediately. I was in Houston. He said, come down, check out the weather. I checked out my first meeting that I could find. It was the friendship group Monday night by the library, and it was horrible being in Houston. People talk so slowly. They said the Lord's Prayer, and oh my God, you could write your autobiography before they were done. You know, on and on. So patience and loving tolerance, and it became a wonderful group, and I got a sponsor there, and I became a sponsor there, and life was good. I didn't have a job. I was tired. I didn't want to look for a job again, but I met a newcomer at the meeting, and she asked me what I did. I told her, and she said, I think we have an opening where I work. She said, let me check. She called me. She said, we do. I had an interview. I went for the interview, and the guy interviewing me said, how did you get here? You know? And I said only, you know, I used to share everything that wasn't even necessary. But I said, I guess it's just a cross between a miracle and a fairy tale. And I'll leave it at that. And he said, well, I've never heard a comment like that before. But I got the job. I worked. I had a good job there. I enjoyed it. And when Herb said, you know, I'd like to leave corporate life, leave Houston and move out west. And, you know, I thought, oh, why not? Keep an open mind. But I had conditions now. I said, I'll go if I can have a cat and a wash machine with a gentle cycle. He said, done deal, you can have them. And we moved, got an apartment, built a house. I found the closest meeting I could find, and my life has gone up from there, and it's gone quickly, and it's been good. My home group, that's where I started. The group representative said, oh, I can't remember to go to those old meetings, you know, the district meeting. I keep forgetting. Anybody want to go? I do. I raised my hand, and I said, because I know what you taught me. I'll meet people, stick with the winners, people serving the fellowship. And so I became an alternate group rep. And then I became the group rep. And our district was in a terrible mess. The DR was very cranky, and she swore a lot. And I didn't really think that reflected the Al-Anon philosophy. But I prayed for her when I went home because I thought, I need to go there. And when we had elections to stand for district rep, I walked in with a woman. She said, I want to be DR so bad I can taste it. I thought, oh, dear, I was thinking of standing. But you know, my sponsor taught me, all you have to do is be willing. You don't make the choice. You just say, yes, I'm willing. We went all around that room, and I became the district rep. And that was a great job because I could go to all the meetings, meet more people, get more recovery. And it's very difficult to hop into a relationship that feels quite healthy. I kept waiting for something to go wrong. I remember when I made an ink mark on one of the chairs in Herb's house. I thought, oh, my God, what am I going to do? That ink mark on the chair, you know. I kept thinking something bad would happen. Nothing bad ever happened. And it takes time. And I remember him asking me when I didn't come right home from a meeting, you know, what do I do if you don't come home? And I said, if I'm not home by midnight, call the cops. That's all I could think of to say, but I'm okay. I'm in the company of friends, and I'm safe. You know? And I continued to go to meetings. I was able to serve as Nevada's delegate to the conference, and I think it's starting to feel like a long time ago. But I know when I was elected, I called my sponsor, who is not well really anymore, and she said, honey, I knew someday you'd be Nevada's delegate. Now, how do people know, once again? They know that you're going to grow and you're going to progress. I enjoyed that journey. I met other people from different areas, of course. I've got a couple great friends in Maine now. I'd never been to Maine, but we've gone to Maine fairly frequently. We have a... we call it a cross-country study group. A few of the delegates that I served with, that we hung out together, we have a book meeting once a month, and we rotate chairing. We go from west to east. It's Nevada, New Mexico, Nebraska, Pennsylvania, Maine. And in fact, I have to chair Monday when I go home. It's my turn, and we've kept that up since 2010. 3 years after I was finished serving as delegate, I had worked on revising the trustee resume for World Service. I was on a task force with the delegates, and I always liked paperwork and improving words, and you know, so I was into fixing up that resume. And then I thought, after 3 years, well, maybe I ought to fill it out myself. And so in the resume, it was posted looking for people to serve as volunteers for the World Service Office. I filled it out, sent it in, and I was called to come for an interview and we do a round robin. People ask you questions and stuff. And And so I was chosen to serve the fellowship as a trustee at large. And I flew to Virginia Beach from Reno regularly, and then I served a second term. So I had 6 years serving, and that's a different kind of service. But I was privileged to go to St. John's, Newfoundland. We had a meeting up there, and oh my gosh, that's one of my favorite memories because people are so up there in that little corner. And they were so thrilled that we were coming. We were in a little crowded room and you could just feel the magic of Al-Anon members, meeting Al-Anon members and, you know, meeting the newfies and hearing the stories and going out and seeing the puffins. I like birds and we took a little trip out on the water, and I thought I never would have been here had it not been for the program. And I went to Guatemala, Guatemala City, and there again I learned how grateful I am for what we have. I have a home group meeting 10 minutes from my house, and people ride buses and make sure their car doors are locked because people may rob you when you stop at a stoplight. And their world office has barbed wire all around it, you know, for security. And their boardroom is not very plush. It's white plastic chairs with folding tables. But for their office structure, it works just fine because it's Al-Anon. So I've had a lot of wonderful adventures. I've met friends. Herb has come with me and, we have an older son and wife. Herb is my husband, if my sponsor's brother. She was so mortified. She said, why didn't I ever think of that? And I said, well, sponsors have good ideas, but they don't always have all the ideas, you know. But I think applying those steps to my life, those steps have helped me come to know myself. And the traditions have helped me come to know you and work with you and have an awareness of other people. And then those concepts have helped me practice what I know to be true. Carry the message to others, you know. There are so many people who suffer from the family disease of alcoholism. I've had an abundance. It's my neighbors. It's my friend's brother. It's someone. There's always an opportunity. And Herb sees it too, and he points it out. You know, it says maybe they could get a little help from you, you know. So we have a lot of work to do because it's a miracle that I survived that. And you might wonder, I suppose, what happened to the alcoholic, and he's deceased. He did die from the disease of alcoholism. And I have learned that's what happens to people. So I think if you're an AA and you're in this room today, you're in the very right place and you're in a safe place, and I want you to keep coming back because I have witnessed what has happened to people who get on the fringes, and it's not pretty. It's not pretty. But when he passed away, I got the call, and I couldn't go because Herb and I, in fact, were going to Maine that very next day, and the call came too late. But I got on the phone and I called a few people that I knew, friends in AA, and I said, you know, he doesn't have anybody. Will you show up at the service if you can and go so that we are represented as a fellowship from both sides? And they did that. And my in-laws said, what nice people. And they were so dazzled that my friend Mel had been sober for 30 years. They couldn't believe that. And I said, the miracle happens. The miracle happens. So I was where I was supposed to be. And if I look back, I feel sad, but I feel grateful because that reminder that the program is for me, it's only for me, and other people have their shot at a miracle and that grace that we heard about last night. So I used to always say no. I'm not a joiner. I'm not a anything. I was working, living, but in Al-Anon, I would be asked, would you like to do something? And I have been all in. I've always said yes. Yes, I will. Like when Lisa called me. And what a blessing that is. She and I have communicated the beautiful basket of little special treats. It just reminds me there's so much love in the world. And there's so much goodness and goodwill. And, you know, I feel it here more than anywhere in the world. And I'm just so grateful because when I said yes to Al-Anon, I really said yes to life. And it's life abundantly. And that is the miracle. So thank you for having me. And I look forward to the rest of the day and the rest of the speakers. And thanks, Cliff, for last night. It's all been great so far. Thank you.